This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martirano. What I do is preside over this program that's all about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. Therein lies the name, Recovery Radio. It's important to remember, in spite of all the justifiably horror stories about the substance abuse problem, the grip of which the country, the nation is in right now, that there are people who get sober. Millions, in fact, are right now living in long-term successful sobriety. Every now and then, to illustrate that point, we bring people in who have, to coin a phrase, been there and done that. The whole thing sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, about which more later. To that end, we welcome to the program another of those first-person accounts that I just mentioned. Charlie Stevenson is our guest on the telephone. We always appreciate it when folks like Charlie, who, as I say, have seen this disease up close and personal and made it out the other side, join us and share their story of sobriety. Charlie, thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Not a problem. Glad to be here.
We like to get to know who you are straight ahead. I say this every time. People are probably tired of hearing it. My expression is that all stories of substance abuse and then recovery are the same, except they're different. So let's talk about what's different. Tell us about yourself. Where'd you grow up? The whole thing.
I was born in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. I think immediately they moved up to Birdsboro, which is a very, very, very small town. I was born into a family that suffered alcoholism. My father was an alcoholic. We then moved to Baldstown, which is right above Birdsboro, Pennsylvania. And as far back as I can remember, it was just a lot of chaos, is the best way to say it.
Charlie, before you continue with your background story, when you say your father was an alcoholic, you know that now. Growing up, was he viewed by you and the rest of the family as an alcoholic?
I didn't. Let's just, you know how they say, I wish I knew then what I knew now.
Right.
You know, it's that saying. I didn't know. I knew he was highly abusive to everybody in the household. My mom did drink, but I think she drank out of necessity.
Right.
I now know the difference between alcohol drinking and necessity drinking to survive.
Mm-hmm. What was your dad?
No, I didn't. I didn't view him as an alcoholic growing up. No.
You certainly didn't view him as someone with a disease, right?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. Was he physically abusive?
100%. Very. I can think back. My nose was probably broken the first time when I was about six.
Six?
6 years old. I've been burnt with cigarettes. He used to do real bad things to my mother and make me watch. Just very, very physical and mentally abusive.
Well, were there siblings? You have brothers and sisters?
I have. I have. My dad had two children prior to being with my mother,
mm-hmm.
and my mother had two children prior to being with my father. I was the only child between the two. So it was weird. Like, the two on dad's side, I guess, treated me a little different.
Mm-hmm.
The two on mom's side treated me a little different. We didn't really get along then. My sister Chrissy, who was my dad's side, passed away when she was, I believe she was 32, from cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't really talk to my brother on that side anymore. I still talk to my sister Connie on my mom's side, and I haven't talked to my brother in quite some time on my mom's
side. Were any of those folks in the family similarly abusing substances as they grew up?
I don't know what my brother Mike's doing. My sister Connie used to drink, but I think she fell under mom's category, like a necessity drinker, because who she chose to be with.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother Tim, yes, he's alcohol.
Yeah, so it's not surprising then, given the traumatic nature of the household and the fact that we know that this disease can run through families, that you wind up abusing substances as well. But so take us through that. When did you find yourself? Well, first of all, what was your first introduction? Was it to alcohol, marijuana, or what?
It was alcohol. My dad used to have these weekend parties. He was what you would call a functioning alcoholic, which means he functioned. He went to work every day. He did not miss work. And he paid for the household because that's how I was raised. That's what the man does. He works and he pays the bill. Then on weekends, he would partake in drinking all weekend long. So he used to throw these parties. And when I was younger, I used to be the kid that went and got the beers. So I would, you know, fill the glasses, but if there was anything left in the glass, I would finish it. I would drink some off and then put more beer in it. So that's kind of like how I got. It was like the norm. That was normal.
Right, right.
Growing up.
And very social. The way a lot of people are introduced to alcohol, they see it as social. There's nothing illegal about it. At what point, how old were you when you were, you know, the bar back there, running around filling glasses up?
Jeepers, I was...
really young, right?
Yeah, 7, 8.
Do you remember what do you remember what the first taste of alcohol was like for you, the very first time?
I do. It's when I used to fill the glasses, and growing up, I'm still a very husky man. I'm not a small guy. So growing up, I was a very husky child, and I really didn't feel like I fit in like all the other kids. I didn't. I just felt different. And a lot of that was my home life, and I couldn't take anybody home on the weekends. But I remember when I used to fill these glasses, and after a couple sips and then a couple swallows, I'd start to feel different. I felt accepted. I felt like everybody else there that night, you know. It was really, it made me feel better.
You know, we've heard that story many, many times. The sense of a hole being filled and a calming nature of this stuff. So I'm not surprised to hear that. So at what point does this, you know, social, dad's having another party, I'm running drinks and drinking some beer. When do you notice it start to accelerate? Right away, or was it gradual?
I guess you could say gradual. I, at about age, it was right when it was the first year I went to seventh grade. I felt sad. That was like my takeoff point. I ran into this guy who turned out to be my best friend through the years, and we were very much alike. His dad became really good friends with my dad, as a matter of fact, because they were very similar. So his upbringing was very similar to mine, and I could take him home, and he understood the chaos. So it was about that time. We just started hanging out. We rode motorcycles in the trails, and we would drink. We would get cases of beer and drink in the woods. At a very young age, instead of getting an allowance, I would get a case of beer and they would, you know, drop me off in the woods and they knew I'd be in the woods all night.
Who, you mean say and they, you mean, just, you mean your folks, your parents?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really? Go ahead.
I think it was more like they knew I was going to do it. So at least do their best, or mom, I should say, because she was the nurturing parent, do her best to make sure at least I was in the woods, I wasn't out hurting their body, I wasn't getting hurt, and we, you know,
did you get in a lot of trouble as a kid?
Absolutely. sir. Absolutely. I'm a firm believer you're a product of your environment. My environment for me was normal. When I first stayed at a kid's house and we didn't get some nightly beating, it was weird. I was like, wow, you know, you don't get beat on. So the anger was the norm. So I would fight at school. And at the time, I would pick on the kids that picked on other kids. I didn't like bullies. To this day, I don't. And now I know it's because that's how I viewed my dad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of ran over. So I, you know, and then I learned to fight. I boxed and stuff at an early age to start protecting my mom. So it kind of rolled over. I became that in which I guess I hated the most. You know, I turned into something I never wanted to be.
And from the drinking, what was the substance progression for you?
The drinking started, then at a very young age, the marijuana started. I played music, and like I wrote poetry, which turned into music. So that lifestyle started, and then the cocaine, and then the heroin, and then, you know.
Yeah, it all sounds so ordinary. Looking back, I'm sure it doesn't seem that way. Charlie Stevenson is our guest. Charlie is going to be celebrating 6 years of sobriety, longest stretch, I think, for Charlie. He has an amazing story of multiple trips in and out of treatment facilities, a never-ending quest to get sober. He's sharing the success he's having now. First, I got to remind you about how this comes about. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. I'm going to take just one moment to tell you, and I wouldn't say it if it weren't true. It doesn't make any difference about who's paying the bills. I know these people. I've seen them at work. I've visited their facilities, and I've checked out their reputation. They are among the leaders in this field. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, they are justifiably proud of the people they've helped and look to help a lot more. The reason, though, they support Recovery Radio is, as they tell me time and again, we want to be an informational conduit. We want to educate people about this disease. If we can help them, we stand ready to do that. But when you give them our phone number, make sure that it's in that spirit. So here it is, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, and I hope you never need to use the number. 855-859-8808. 855-859-8808. Again, any questions you have about this disease or something that's going on in your life or treatment you're receiving now, questions about insurance, they'll give you good answers. They really will. And if they can help you, they'll give you world-class treatment as well. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Center, sponsors of Recovery Radio, 855-859-8808. Charlie Stevenson knows exactly what I'm talking about. He abused substances for many, many years, had the sort of a textbook example of a traumatic childhood, as traumatizing as any I've ever heard, and as a result, abused a lot of substances in an effort to try to get sober in and out of treatment centers. Charlie, when you talk about, you know, finding that high that finally takes some of the pain away, then takes over and just dominates your life. Do you remember the point at which heroin for you stopped being a kind of seductress and something that made you feel better and became your master? Is that change too subtle for people with this disease to notice, or did you notice things changing?
I don't know if I actually noticed it then. Well, what happens is it stops working. You start out and it makes you feel better. And then it doesn't make you feel better all the time. And then it's just bad. Like, you get to the point where you're not getting high anymore. You're either doing too much or you're just maintaining. You're not being sick. So it's to look at it now, it gradually did it, but then you just kind of, you get to the point where it's not good anymore, but you continue to do it because you have to.
The disease just seems to change your ability to perceive anything for what it really is, and it becomes all-consuming. This thing about maintaining your kind of equilibrium, avoiding being what they call dope sick, the best you can, explain to somebody why getting sick during withdrawal is so terrifying to an addict.
Okay. Because, for one, you can't do anything. You can't get up and go to work. You can't be around your kids. You can't be around your wife, or if you're still young, your parents, which they are today. They're very young. I talked to some people today, and it's devastating to me. And you just can't do anything. And, you know, it's a lengthy process just being sick alone. I mean, the first day is bad. The second day is even worse. Two and three are super bad. Then it's 3 or 4 days after that you're going to be out of function. And then your sleep has been stuck for, you know, quite a while. And so it's like...
But Charlie, let me push back on this and be sort of an outside advocate of this notion. We have... Some of us have been seriously sick from serious flus or conditions. Very often people in that shape want someone around to help them to get them the soup and their fevered brow and all of that stuff. Why do you think you have to isolate yourself so thoroughly when it's heroin that's making you sick?
Because you feel disgusting. I was so good at self-loathing, I didn't need help from anybody. I hated myself.
So you're sick, but ashamed of being sick.
Yeah, you feel like a piece of crap. Like, when you're sick, it's when, like, the emotions kind of kick back in, and you're thinking about all the people you left down. Once again, sorry means nothing. So that's going through your head, and then you see yourself in the mirror and you look disgusting, you know, then you have that. And then you feel like it's going to be forever. You're never going to be able to be normal, or what people say, normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so devastating.
Yeah,
that you need to numb back up. Because when you're numb, you feel nothing. You care about nothing. The only thing growing through your head is your next fix. You gotta go to work and get your next fix. That's it.
Yeah. Generally speaking, after being sick, and you were many times, I'm sure, how quickly were you back using again? Immediately?
Pretty much, yeah. It wasn't until the end of my run that I got some sober time, but I didn't do it properly. So that lasted a year, but other than that, I couldn't get a month, not even. I couldn't get 2 weeks.
What was your personal life like? That were you married? Were you in relationships? Were you working? What were you doing during that, as you say, run?
I usually always work because you need the income coming in. It's funny because I met a girl through a prison window, and I fell in love with her the first time I saw her. And
which side of the window were you on?
I was in jail.
Okay.
And it was a friend that was in jail with me, had a sister come visit me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I said to myself, I'm going to marry her. And I did. And it was, I guess, the first girl that I'd been with that wasn't like me. She wasn't an addict. So I made her life a living hell. And then, yeah, I have two stepchildren, which I view as my kids. I have two biological children, which are still in the household. But her and I had split up for like 11 years. And now we're back together because I was able to get well. Sweet. Not that I'll ever be healed.
Yep.
But, I'm functioning today. I'm a pretty good guy today, actually.
So Charlie, tell us the circumstances that got you to rehab the first time. Was it court mandated or something like this?
This is kind of neat because the first time I ever went to a rehab, I was 18 years old and I didn't want to go to jail. My dad's insurance still covered me, so I went to a place that was called Terrasis, which turned out to be Premier. It's the same building as the place up in Ephrata.
Yeah.
Retreat.
Oh, you mean?
And
the,
I didn't
mean,
know it.
You mean,
I worked there for a while.
Yeah.
As a CA.
Yeah.
And I came to realization. I'm like, man, this is the same place I came to the first time.
Well, it's like going to somebody's house that has been sold more than once. So you got there because you didn't want to go to jail?
Yes.
So a court said get to rehab. So what was your frame of mind? Your frame of mind was, well, this is better than jail, even if it's not going to do anything for me. Is that it?
Well, yeah, and actually it was pretty nice. Like, I had a guy that came in and cooked every day. So being there, I didn't mind. I'd always been in trouble and on probation, but I'd never been to jail yet. And the concept of prison scared me, but it wasn't surely that after I got out of the rehab and went right back to what I was doing, because that was normal. To me, it always was normal because everybody I knew did what I did.
Right.
So as soon as I got out, I started back up, and it wasn't but 2 months later and I got locked up for the first time.
When you say the first time you went to rehab and then you came back out and started using again, how quickly after the first stint in rehab were you using again? Immediately?
Immediately.
Yeah. What were you doing during that? Were you just going through the motions or what? What were you doing during rehab that it didn't take?
I listened to what they said, but it wasn't me. I did what I did because that's what we did. We partied. I could stop anytime I wanted.
And what was your attitude about the people that were around you that were also struggling? You thought you were different than they were?
A lot of them were young, so they were kind of just like me at that time. Like, it was 18 was the oldest you could be to be at the certain point I was at.
Yeah, but why didn't you identify with them as having a problem?
Because I didn't have a problem. I was blind to it. Like, you know, I'm not like them, is what you tell yourself. They're nice enough folks, but I don't have a problem. That's the best way I can say.
Charlie, how many times were you in and out of rehab that you can recall?
Oh, Jesus Creeper. In prison and out of prison, at least 15 times.
15 times?
At least, yes.
Our guest on the telephone is Charlie Stevenson. Charlie has been up and down, over and out, and certainly seen the disease of addiction from a very, very unfortunate vantage point. Many, many years of abusing substances, everything beginning with alcohol right up to IV use of heroin. He is now, at the longest stretch of his life, sober, going on 6 years. He's joined us to tell us about that road to recovery. So Charlie... the whole process of beginning with alcohol, well, I should say the process for you actually began with the trauma of your home life. Alcohol used as sort of a self-medicating mechanism. Everything seems normal. You gravitate towards a lifestyle and people, friends who reflect the same interests you have, which is you know, getting high most of the time. How quickly did you arrive at serious substance abuse, heroin? How long did that process take?
Okay. I think it took a little longer because heroin was not what it is today. Back then, it was still viewed as, you know, it was just something you didn't do. That was big time. And I, what happened was playing music and stuff, and, you know, you would be up and not be able to get the proper sleep before work. And I used to get, like, I would drink, and we were at the bar one night, and I don't know if I was old enough to drink, but we were at the bar, and I was just very rowdy, we can say. I was not a pleasant guy, loud, boisterous. And the guy I talked about that I met, my best friend, Brad, he was, he said, come on outside, I want you to try something. And he told me what it was, and I was very skeptical. But, you know, he was doing it, so I tried it. And I can remember the first time I tried it. I can remember 15 minutes later, the warm explosion that happened inside, and I fell in love. It was probably, at that moment in my life, the greatest thing I ever felt. I thought.
What time frame are we talking about? When did this occur? What year around?
Okay, well, let's say I'm going to be 47 this year. I was probably 19.
Okay, so it's 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago that you were introduced to heroin, and
probably 1980.
Yeah, and you again mentioned what I've heard in the past about people who manage to find themselves introduced to heroin and then wind up with a problem can, just as you have, describe that first moment as absolutely blissful. Did you think at any? I mean, I understand your the context in which heroin is viewed today is much, much different than when you were introduced to it. It was something that wasn't even spoken about. Only really hardcore, seriously, you know, messed up people fooled around with that stuff. Did you ever think, I'll never stick a needle in my arm?
Absolutely not. I until heroin was introduced to me, I didn't like needles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't like going to the doctor. I didn't like getting poked. But it really wasn't long after that first moment that somebody said to me, listen, you're missing like 38% of this high. And that was unacceptable.
Right.
You know, I can remember my dad years ago telling me, be the best at whatever you do, be the best. And I, you know, I did that. I was the best jerk. I was the best alcoholic. I was the best drug addict I could be. You know, I started injecting it. And once you do that, you don't snort it no more. You don't smoke it no more. You don't do anything. And then pretty soon you find yourself. It got to the point that with the cocaine, it would have to be intravenous. I've shot liquor because of instant effect, because I didn't want to wait.
Really? How many times did you overdose?
To date, and this is going by memory, I believe I've had 10 or 12 overdoses, and I was flatlined probably 6 or 7 times.
Yeah, all from heroin, or did you? I mean, I've never heard of anybody shooting alcohol.
Heroin and alcohol are the combination of the two is deadly in 50% of the cases, and I would sometimes use the alcohol to mix up the heroin.
Yeah. Explain, you're not a stupid man. Even in the grip of this drug, these drugs, you're not a dumb man. You knew what the stakes were.
Not at all.
Explain to people listening who go, well, why would anybody who OD'd 6 or 7 times not be scared? Why were you not scared?
Because I honestly think you get to the point you don't care. You know, looking back on it, my childhood was horrible. But that was nothing compared to the insanity and the grip that which I always called Lady Heroin. I always mixed it. It was like a woman that you just couldn't get away from. And you get so sick and you don't know what to do and you feel hopeless and you feel lost and you feel scared, and it's the only thing, it's the only substance that's going to make you feel better at that moment in time. And you always think, so next time I just won't do as much. Next time I won't shoot it, I'll snort it, you know, and knowing in your head you're going to, but you tell yourself anyway.
You make these bargains you make a bargain with the disease every time.
You make a bargain with the devil. You're dancing with the devil every time.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We've been speaking with Charlie Stevenson. Charlie has been kind enough to join us to talk about his experience with very, very serious family trauma and abuse, substance abuse, physical abuse, in and out of jail because of a serious drug habit, and multiple trips to rehab. And Charlie told us earlier that he thought upwards of 15 times in and out, both in prison and in private life. So Charlie, each and every time prior to the last 6 years ago, you were either coerced because of the criminal justice system in getting back into treatment, or genuinely thought maybe I can help myself. What was different, as far as you can recall, about the last time? Well, I mean, something changed 6 years ago. This is the longest time you have been sober. Have you thought about what it was?
8 years ago, I went into treatment and I went to a meeting, and a guy came in, raised his hand, and he shared about his dog getting hit by a car, and he was sobbing. Something in my head said, ask this guy to be my sponsor because he knows how to love and I don't. So I did that, and I got out of the rehab, and for a year, I stayed clean and sober. The problem was I didn't do any work on myself. But I met a lot of people.
Wait, back up a second. So for people who don't understand, for a year you abstained from abusing. But you say you didn't do any work on yourself. What do you mean? If you were abstaining, why wasn't that enough?
There's a step process you got to go through, because you got to take a look at yourself and what makes you tick and some faults you might have. And you have to do that. You have to get spiritual. Like I could say today, I love God. God is always there when I need him to be there. And he always was. I just didn't know it. That's why I'm not dead. So I went to a lot of meetings and I met some new people. So after a year when I relapsed, it was the worst. Now I'm around people again who don't really love me, who haven't been through turmoil and can still smile. And it was horrible. And at the end of that year, I was at the point, I don't care if I die. Something said, go back to rehab. So I went back to the Reading DNA. And they're great people there, man. They love you. And something somebody said was, take a look left and right. And I did, and we were sitting in a group. He said, one of you is going to make it. That's the statistic. And in my head, I said, I'm going to be that one. He then said again, take a look left and right. So I did that. He said, in 1 year, statistics says one of you will be dead. It's been 6 years, and I think there's like seven people that are now dead that I was in there with, because Reading's kind of a small town, and you know a lot of the people.
Yeah, it really does, on some level, come down to those two choices. You can either get it together and get sober, or you're going to die. I mean, it really is that stark. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, some people die. You didn't. And you talk about spirituality. which I'm sure for many people puts them off. When you say spiritual, you mean God directly, don't you?
Well, yeah, that and living the right kind of way, yeah.
What do you say to someone who goes, yeah, but I got to get sober without believing in God because that's hard for me? What do you tell them about the spiritual component if God doesn't work for them?
Well, and I'll talk to them about, you know, why, what's the issue with God if you don't believe or you're just mad at him like I was. And you kind of go from there. You have to feel it out. And you just, because I worked with a guy, and he stayed sober for quite a long time, that in his head, God was aliens, and it worked for him.
Yeah, as long as it's something.
And you just continue to do that.
As long as it's something outside and larger than yourself. What else has been helping you, Charlie? Well, I mean, I know you probably came out of rehab that last time and did some sober living and transitioned yourself back into sober society. How important is it? Well, first of all, let me ask you something, and this is a tough one. Do you ever get is sobriety boring? Because I hear people, you know, they go, gee, they must be bored to death being sober. Is that true?
If you allow yourself to get bored. I mean, I have moments where I'm sitting on the couch and I'm like, you know, something more exciting would be a great idea, but no, because we just got back from a camping trip up above Jim Thorpe, and everybody's sober that goes, and it's a phenomenal time. And I can say I remember every band that played at every concert I've seen in the past 6 years. And you do stuff. You have picnics, and you call one another, and you learn a whole new concept of friendship.
Yeah.
And I play music, and I'm a spiritual worship leader at church on Sunday mornings. Tonight, I'm going down to my church for a thing called Alpha, where I'm going to cook and we're all going to eat together and we're going to talk about spirituality and God and Jesus. And so, no. I mean, can you allow it to be boring and do nothing? Yeah. But if you step outside yourself and you help other people and you work with people, no.
As a member of the Retreat Alumni Group, you get a lot of that community bonding through that group,
yes.
Right?
Absolutely. I go, and anytime they call me to go up and speak at the meeting they have on Tuesday nights, I go. And I always see people that was there when I worked at the place, you know. Alumni is great. The alumni lets you know people do make it. There's hope. There is definitely light at the end of the tunnel. You just have to be willing to maybe fight a little bit to get to it.
Charlie Stevenson. Go ahead, Charlie. I'm sorry.
Oh, I discovered people had a glow, and that's what kind of stuck. Somebody's talking about how their life was hell, but yet they were smiling, and I wanted that glow, and I went after it, and I got it, but I didn't even know I had it when I got it. So somebody came up to me and said, listen, I'd like you to sponsor me. Can you work with me? And that means you're attracting people.
Right. They saw it. They saw it in you, yeah. Hey, Charlie, thanks so much for taking the time. And the odds sure were stacked against you, given your family history and all of that. And you had a rough go of it. But going on 6 years sober, quite an achievement. Continued success, pal. And thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Not a problem, man. Loved it.
Thanks, Charlie. Thank you all for spending this time with us. Look for Recovery Radio each and every Saturday. Join the weekend. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.